traveling with me.
Welcome to another episode of the Bowery Capital Startup Sales Podcast. I'm your host, Jess Benito, and today we're hosting Rick Smolin, who was the former VP of Sales at Intralinx and at Greenhouse. Today he's going to be talking to us about why your sales capacity plan doesn't work. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hello, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to have you on the show. Before we get into today's topic, can you please share a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I view myself as a passionate sales professional. I've been in sales now for almost 20 years, and I love what I do. So I run to work every day. First and foremost, I do think of myself as like a sales professional and being involved with the customer. And then over the last 12 years, I've gone through an evolution of sales leadership and as a student of how to be a better leader and have a bigger impact on organizations. And so currently, I'm spending a lot of time working with companies in a consulting capacity and helping to think about all types of elements of go-to-market, from what are things that we can do differently and how do we sell better and how do we teach and build a team over time.
So before we dive into the topic, can you share one fun thing that none of our listeners know about you?
Oh, fun thing about me. So I think my best days are behind me because I was a childhood actor. And so I spent a lot of time as a kid commuting to New York City and doing auditions, and I was in all kinds of random things, but probably not many that you've heard of.
Okay.
And I aspire moving forward to potentially get back into acting one day, but that's been an aspiration for quite a while. And yet the action behind it hasn't really happened yet.
Well, that's awesome. I feel like maybe we need to rewind a little bit. How did you go from acting into sales?
So I guess the acting is about performance,
yeah.
And so I think I just had that in me as a kid. And as you grow up, that sort of personality-driven extroversion and being interested in other people, when I got to college, I just like found my way to the college newspaper. And I started selling ads for the newspaper, and so I started getting to know people around town and the businesses around town, and I just loved it. In fact, I graduated and stuck around a while and continued to sell ads for the paper. I then went into finance for a little while, and just through like organic, you know, experimentation and jobs, found myself eventually ending up in sales because it matched up best with my skill set and what I enjoyed doing and where I had the most impact for companies.
That's awesome. I love it. All right, so let's dive in. Can you break down for us, what is a sales capacity plan?
Sure. When I think about a sales capacity plan, I think about companies that are focused on growth. So they're trying to grow. There's a lot of ambition. Many of them are venture-backed, so they have a growth imperative. And the easiest way they think about growth is, how do I add more sales capacity? That means, how do I add more account executives? Mm-hmm. If I add more account executives, that means more quota. If I have more quota, great. I have the ability to hit whatever target that the CEO or the board wants to deliver on. And so because it's the most intuitive, it's the easiest to see, right? Quota is quite clear. It's where a lot of companies spend their time planning out. But one of the issues that eventually they run into is it doesn't work at some point. You get to this diminishing marginal utility, and then you don't know why. And so I find it interesting that that there many, many companies continue to fall into the same trap of exclusively building their growth plans centered around how many account executives they can hire and how much quota they can allocate out to a team.
Got it. Okay. And so I guess in practice, like, map that out for us a little bit. How does that methodology actually work?
So, I mean, the real simple example would be I'm a business, I'm growing, I want to add 10 million of ARR, for example, next year. I have 5 AEs right now that do 1 million each, so I need to hire 5 more, and they'll do 1 million each, and that'll be 10 million. And as I continue to grow, every time I want to add an extra million of new business, I just add another account executive. So really easy, fits nicely into a spreadsheet, as long as I can continue generating new opportunities for them. They can close at the same conversion rate and the same contract value. It'll work fine. The problem with that is it doesn't quite always work that way. And so there's a lot of challenges that end up happening. And when you're hiring a bunch of account executives and you start to hit the wall and there aren't enough opportunities for them, there's a lot of like ripple effect problems that comes from that.
Got it. Okay. And so I guess talk to us a little bit more about some of those common mistakes that you have seen companies make specifically with planning, and how do you think they can be avoided?
Yeah, so what I have seen a lot, and this isn't a new topic, but I just continue to see it over again, is this idea of not focusing enough on the top of the funnel. They're not focused enough on how confident and good are we at being able to project the volume of new opportunities or leads we can bring into the organization and anchoring to that volume of opportunities. So, and then building a headcount plan around the top of the funnel. So that is the methodology that I think works the best, right? You want to have you want to have operational rigor around demand gen so that you know, what is it costing me to bring in X number of leads? What are the best performing channels to do that? And then only after you feel like you've got your sort of buttons pushed and your, levers to pull around how to do that well, then you can fill in, okay, how many account executives will I need to be able to take that on? So let's go through an example. A company starts out, CEO has success selling the product to the market. They hire a couple of salespeople, they get to a few million dollars of ARR, they're super excited, they go out and raise funding, and now they've got money, so they go and hire a bunch more salespeople, thinking that they'll get the same volume of opportunities, they'll be able to close them at the same rate. But the early adopters eventually run out, and it becomes a little bit tougher. And so you don't know at what point you're gonna hit the wall. Sometimes you can hit the wall at 50 million. You might have an amazing product in an emerging market that's growing really fast, but if you don't have the discipline around how are we generating top of the funnel, the bigger your organization gets, when things go wrong, you don't know what happened. So at first you throw more bodies at it, you make it worse, but then eventually you realize, okay, we're gonna have to kind of deconstruct this and figure out how many opportunities do we actually bring into this company? How good are we at projecting that? And then do I have enough capacity in sales to handle that volume? And where do I need to be moving forward? And so the companies that I think do this really well spend time actually forecasting the top of the funnel. You know, you hear all about forecast calls and sales managers and committing to the number and all that, but that same type of rigor should be happening at the number of opportunities we're going to generate, whether that be by segment or overall. And then based on the commitment of opportunities, say, great, sounds like we're going to grow our op volume in the second half of this year by 20%. I'm going to plan for that increase in demand by hiring in the second quarter, training up new reps, and then naturally that increase in demand will result. I'll have the sales capacity to be able to handle it. So that you would call that marketing led with sales coming in behind it to be able to handle it. Most companies seem to do the opposite of that.
Right.
And so that's the sort of error that I guess I see the most. And so the coaching or consulting that I inevitably end up doing is to try to foster a little bit of stronger alignment between marketing and the top of the funnel, the campaigns they're running, and then what that means for the volume of sellers and then the seller's approach.
Got it, okay. And what if this is a company that is solving for something that people aren't searching for, right? So when you think about this from a demand gen perspective, does this apply when it's not a known problem?
Well, sure. So I think it applies in any type of selling context. In a new emerging category that maybe doesn't exist today, your early stages of that company's, development, you are figuring out what that sales process looks like. You have, your founders and maybe your initial account executives figuring out what's the formula for success to evangelize this new concept. Eventually, they do have some success and they start to create this new and emerging category, let's say. At that point, they've basically developed an actual sales process, right? So it's not about taking somebody's budget, but it's about helping a customer realize they have a problem that is worth spending money on to fix. And now you want to build repeatability in helping other customers that don't even know they have this problem understand that it exists, what the costs of it are, what the ROI would be if they fixed it, and now you've actually created this new category. But the same principles of, can I generate enough demo requests or discovery calls or engagement with these prospective customers to be able to have the right number of AEs to fill in behind it? So, you know, there are other interesting elements that come with, are you pursuing a market that has an existing budget line item and you have to knock out the legacy or incumbent provider to be able to do that? And then there's other dynamics around these emerging categories where you have to find a pain that's big enough where a company decides they're going to spend money that wasn't budgeted for to fix the problem. Both are fascinating in their own ways, but I still think the same rules apply for how you build a sort of funnel-based model of, you know, thinking about your investments and how you deliver good CAC to LTV and the rest of it.
Got it. Okay. And so let's talk a little bit about hiring. So by the time you've got an overwhelming pipeline to the point where your existing AEs and now dropping the ball on deals, it's almost too late to start your search for the next AE. How do you think about hiring so that AEs are coming into seat with enough pipeline and enough ramp time?
So there's a few different things, I guess, that come up when you think about a hiring plan. And yet, I would rather be in a position where I have a few AEs that have a lot of opportunities, and maybe they're drowning in opportunities, than a situation where I hire a bunch of AEs and there's not enough opportunities for them. And now I have to take a bunch of their time doing prospecting and the rest that should be used for closing business or moving deals forward. Of course, you want to have your sellers doing some level of prospecting for accountability and discipline and a bunch of other good reasons. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to have them spending an inordinate amount of time doing that. And if they don't have an existing pipeline or they don't have leads coming their way, then they have no choice but to do that. And it's just a really inefficient and expensive way to go. So imagine you're in a situation where you are projecting out what demand's going to be because you're going to invest in SDRs, you're going to invest in ABM, you're going to do these events, you're going to go to the big industry show, and you're going to anticipate and be good at determining what that's going to result in terms of opportunities in the future, and you're planning that out for the year. Now you can say, okay, based on my anticipation of growth within the top of the funnel, I can hire people in, and let me have a realistic sense of what it'll take to ramp them, and let me make those hires in advance so that I can train them up in such a way that it fits in nicely. And if in the short term my existing sellers have too much on their plate, that's actually probably a good problem to have. You know, I've sort of heard anecdotally from CEOs and other sales leaders that AEs that have too many opportunities tend to perform better than AEs that even have just enough, and certainly better than AEs that don't have enough. There's something about an additional motivation that, like, let me get after it while the getting's good. And so if you do have a short-term dynamic where your existing AE team has too many opportunities based on your financial model, that's a better issue to have where you can ramp in new people than to have, you know, a lot of AEs and not enough opportunities for them.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about some of the side effects when sales capacity planning doesn't go according to plan. How do you think about managing messaging with the immediate team, with your leadership team, with the broader team? And how do you manage team morale in those instances?
Well, you hope you're not in the situation. While I haven't personally been in the situation, I think this is what happens. You start to have this huge pipeline of fake opportunities. And so, you know, there's so much urgency from the top down that we need more pipeline, we need more deals. And so opportunities don't get closed out as lost. Opportunities get a birthday. And so you have folks around the office bringing a birthday cake in for the AE because their opportunity just had a birthday. and then, you know, if you do, maybe you're a sales leader and you inherit a situation like this, I think there's drastic action is sort of required. You know, you got to review the pipeline and sort of clean it up in such a way where you feel like there's clarity of what's real and what isn't. You have to sort of pivot and say, okay, what are we doing in terms of op creation? How good are we at bringing leads into this business? And when we spend money, knowing what we're going to bring in and in return in terms of top of the funnel? And what do we need underneath that in terms of the number of sellers to be able to handle that volume? Morale is very difficult to improve if you don't actually make the changes to have the right sort of levels. So you can cheer people up or root them on, but if they're not in a position to hit their number, it's only going to be Band-Aids, and it won't be really a long-term fix. So, you know, companies where they run into this, when they hit the wall and run into issues around a sales capacity model, will typically have to do a reduction in force, will typically have to sort of pull back, and that has real consequences, and nobody enjoys that. But the faster they sort of right-size the business to be able to pursue it, the easier it will be moving forward to sort of lead and you know, take the lessons from that and change a little bit moving forward.
Got it. And so just kind of thinking about everything you've talked through today, specific to sales capacity planning, it's so obvious that you've got to think about this a little bit more broader. You sometimes have to think about this more from even a bottom-up pipeline-driven approach, right? Why do you think so many companies make this mistake?
I think it's intuitive to hire more sellers. I think it's like, you know, most people are really smart and really logical, and they see that what's worked for me in the past, why won't that just continue to work? There's this huge market opportunity here. I could have thousands of customers. Anybody that's a company could benefit from my solution, as an example. And I closed these first deals, and my first two sellers closed these deals. Like, things are good. I just pour more gasoline on it. Here's more quota. We have a great hiring plan. Like, we're really good at this. So let me bring people on. It's quite intuitive to do it that way. Also, marketing's hard. Like, I argued, maybe because I'm a sales background and I have a lot of experience in it, but I just admire great marketing executives because there is so many more variables and items to figure out, and in order to be able to optimize, how do we be really smart about making investments that are going to return leads to our business? And whereas it's easier to spot, okay, you're a seller, you'll come in, I give you $1 million quota, that's really easy to see. There's no complexity in that. Whereas a great marketing leader that has, you know, sort of 5, 6, 7 channels of activities that they need to do to build a brand, to do field work, to do demand gen, you know, to do content, to do product, to do everything that's sort of required, you know, from that aspect. It's just not as intuitive. It's harder to find that level of talent. And inevitably, you don't have a lot of time in a startup. Like, you don't have some deep thinking. You're execute, execute, execute. And so it just gets missed at times, I think. But the lucky companies that do bring in amazing marketing leadership that can sort of set the organization up in this way, they get, I think, outsized returns for that.
So you mentioned it's really hard to find good marketing talent. What do companies do when they can't find that marketing person or they can't quite afford them? What do they do in those sort of instances?
Well, I mean, you know, just because it's hard doesn't mean it's not worth doing. So it's hard to find great sales talent, but you don't just hire the first person you meet, you know, that walks in the door. There are more and more companies are getting more and more sophisticated about how they handle any aspect of marketing. There is a whole new emerging set of future leaders that are being trained up by the best. And so whether you're able to bring in a seasoned CMO or you're able to bring in high potential talent that's gotten exposure to from a really good organization, you gotta see what's, you know, based on your market, your company, what opportunities exist. And you gotta be creative, just like in your product strategy, just like in your finance operation, just like in any other aspect of your business, to say, what are my needs here? And how do I find the right type of person that can either develop into a more senior person, or I can get the great CMO that's done this before and join? And based on that, make your decisions. So there is not a one-size-fits-all approach, but just because it's hard doesn't mean we like do a shortcut and don't do it at all.
I'm curious, what are you seeing out there now that you're in a consulting role? What else kind of works and what else is interesting?
So as I talk to businesses, I think about a go-to-market approach from three avenues, right? So one, we have demand gen. So we've talked a lot about demand gen and how good and focused is an organization at developing their pipeline. And so whether it be SDRs or inbound approaches, how good is the organization at thinking about that, at predicting it, and running their business off of that is one lens. Sales operations is another. And you know, that's everything from process and comp plans and tools and reporting and all these other elements. And so how are companies doing there? There's a lot going on. And then lastly, there's sales process. How do we actually engage with the customer, and how do we do that in such a way that's consistent and powerful and customer centric, not like how awesome our product is. So the other thing I'm spending a lot of time doing is working with companies to help them improve the consistency and quality of their sales conversation with customers.
Okay. And maybe tell us a little bit more on that end. How are you doing that exactly?
Sure. So a lot of what I see happen a lot is a company brings in a new seller into the organization. They train them up on their product, and the product is awesome. And the product can do so many things, and they spend the first several weeks getting a new seller sort of fluent or proficient within how to talk about all these amazing things that the product can do. And then the seller gets out into the market, and naturally they want to evangelize. They want to show all the great stuff that the product can do. So they do discovery, they ask questions, they hear, oh, there's a problem there, or oh, I have a problem with this, and they jump right into, cool, here's how I can fix that problem. And they show all the cool things that the product can do. And hey, just stop me when you see something you like. And so, you know, it's either like you're given free sort of window shopping, or you're given a free education to the market, but you're not actually helping a customer think about how big their problem is and what it would mean to actually fix it. And so what I spend time doing now with companies is trying to go and take an outside-in approach. And let's define our company and our products by the problems that we solve for customers, and not just by what our product can do. And that's it's a sort of inversion of how I see a lot of sellers approach their customers. And so the sellers that approach their customers with a real, you know, heartfelt, genuine desire to help that prospective customer materially improve something important that's going to result in more revenue or lower cost or reduced risk for that business, and then be really focused on the customer, and then only talk about the solution that you know, the company delivers to this new customer in a way that's relevant to them. I think there's a huge opportunity to do that better for companies, and so that's what I spend a lot of my time helping, you know, companies figure out.
And is there a right time to maybe bring somebody in like you into an organization?
I think the depth and the breadth of a project can vary based upon how mature or how large an organization is, or how many products it has, or how complicated their sales process is. But I think the benefit of bringing in some thought, you know, some third-party thought about how do we approach customers and what problems do we solve for them and how do we do it better and differently, the earlier you do that, the better. And so you can do it simply when you're small, and you can do it in a much more extensive way when you're large and you have dozens of sellers and you're global or have lots of offices and a distributed team and that kind of thing. So I think it's relevant to all companies. I think the markets shift a whole bunch. And so you have to change the way you sell, or your product pivots, or, you know, all these different ways. And so I think there's an opportunity. I think just the scope of a consulting engagement will vary based on, you know, where a company is.
Right. So any final tips that you have for our listeners?
So I guess if you're a seller out there and you're engaged with a customer and you're excited about the problems that you solve and what your product can do, and you're pumped and you want to hit your quota and you're super passionate, the two best questions you can ask a customer is, tell me more about that, and who else cares about that? And if you on every call can find opportunities to go deeper with the customer, other than the awesome flag of you know, pain that you just saw, you will be able to go, you know, deeper, help the customer realize how big the problem is, and put yourself in a better position to have that deal close and not generate its birthday and sit in the pipeline for a long time.
Thank you for being on the show, Rick. It was really great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jessica. Appreciate it. Now I'm towing my car. There's a hole in the roof. My possessions are causing me suspicion, but there's no proof. In the paper today, tales of war and